I encourage you to have 1 Kings chapter 12 open, page 351, if you have a blue Bible from our church. Promise no more radio-controlled cars or surprises for the remainder of our time. If there is, it's nothing to do with me, but God's in control, so that's good. Now, I don't know whether you've ever asked a question or whether you've been asked this kind of question. How can Christianity be the only true religion when there are so many alternatives? Well, that's a question that you've been asked, or whether you've thought, or perhaps, you know, if God is all-powerful, why does he tolerate opposition to his plans? Those kind of questions. I wonder if you've asked those kind of questions, or had those questions asked of you. Does the Bible have any answers to those questions? Well, I think it does. We're not going to do that completely this morning. But I do think that this passage really helps us to know, or to, points us in the right direction, sets us on the right course, perhaps. And see, the Bible is clear, isn't it, from the very, very beginning, that even rival and evil kingdoms are part of God's purposes in this world. It teaches us right from the beginning, Adam and Eve, the first human beings, rebelling against God's kingly rule. And yet, God doesn't destroy them completely, does he? And we see that throughout the Bible. And in 1 Kings 12, we see that again this morning. Let me remind you of what we've seen so far in 1 Kings. We've had the most amazing picture, haven't we, of what it looks like when we let God rule. When a people of God let God rule, we've seen the most amazing things. I don't know whether you've had an excitement as you've listened or thought about these things, but my response has been, I want to be there. I don't know about you. If you haven't, then that's probably my fault rather than yours, but that's my fear. I want to be there. We've seen God's people have God's king at the centre. God is at the heart of the people and in the hearts of the people. The people are happy. They're united. Jerusalem is like the centre of the universe. Literally, nations are streaming to it to find out, to hear from Solomon all about, you know, what God is like. Their influence is kind of spreading across the globe. God's kingdom has been established on earth. It is growing. Everyone's happy. It's a good place to be. I want to be there. But it could almost be described as a new creation, if you like. Solomon is almost like a kind of a second Adam. But in chapter 11, a couple of weeks ago, we saw that Solomon was actually too much like Adam, didn't we? We saw that he turned away from God and he worshipped idols. He failed to continue to let God rule, and God's kingdom on earth begins to crumble again. But we also saw that despite this faithfulness of the king, King Solomon, God promised to remain faithful to his promise to David, Solomon's father. He had promised David that he would always have a son on the throne. And although David's family would be humbled, it would not be forever. That was God's promise. But for the time being, it is all about humility. We're going to see a couple of things in this chapter this morning. Firstly, we're going to think about God's doing. He is sovereign over stupidity. So we teach our kids not to use the word stupid. So this is a bit of a... Anyway, but it begins with S, right? So he's got a... That's my excuse. God is sovereign over stupidity. Secondly, we see Jeroboam's doing. That's in verses 25 to 33. And we see he is ignorant in idolatry. So let's think about God's doing. He is sovereign over stupidity. So when we begin chapter 12, King Solomon has died. His son Rehoboam succeeds him as king. But the Lord has already promised, if you remember, if you were here last 2 weeks ago, that because of Solomon's failure, he is going to dismantle the kingdom and tear most of it away from his son and give it to a rival, Jeroboam. Now, unfortunately, they both end in Oboam. All right, so you've just got to remember that Re is Solomon's son and Jer is someone else. All right, so Rehoboam is Solomon's son. Jeroboam is the rival king who gets set up. This kind of section explains how God does it, and it leaves us in no doubt that it's the Lord's doing. We thought about that already. Let me just remind us, point us to the fact that God is sovereign. Look at God's sovereignty. Verse 15, in all that happens, we learn that this turn of events was from the Lord to fulfill the word the Lord had spoken to Jeroboam, son of Nebat, through Ahijah the Shilonite. And then verse 24, the word of the Lord came to Rehoboam through the prophet Shemaiah to say, go home, every one of you, for this is my doing. This all happens because of the determined will of God. It's his doing. He is sovereign. Let's have a look at Rehoboam's stupidity then. See, God's sovereignty, his sovereign plan, is worked out through the actions of responsible, or we might say irresponsible, human beings, both responsible or irresponsible. Regardless, God works out his plan. Let's have a look at verse 1, and we'll follow the story through. Rehoboam goes to Shechem, for all Israel had gone there to make him king. But when Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard this, he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon. He returned from Egypt. So Jeroboam was in Egypt because somehow Solomon had found out that Jeroboam was trying to take his throne. He tried to kill him, so Jeroboam legs it to Egypt. And he's still there, but as soon as he hears that Solomon has died, he comes back. So you've got Rehoboam, the one who should be king, Jeroboam, the one whose God has promised to set up a rival kingdom. Now Rehoboam, Solomon's son, was the opposite of his father. Solomon was known for his wisdom and his wise ruling in the people. If you cast your minds back to chapter 4, he prays to God, give your servant, talking of himself, a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. And do you remember that amazing story about those two prostitutes with one child, and they come to Solomon and he's got to try and work out, you know, who the baby belongs to, and he makes the wise, right decision. He's wise. He's been blessed with wisdom. And the blessing of having a king like that is that the people lived in unity. We read that Solomon ruled over all Israel. But with Rehoboam, we see the exact opposites. A lack of wisdom leading to the destruction of unity. Let's have a look at his lack of wisdom. Verse 3, the whole assembly send for Jeroboam, and he heads up this kind of delegation who approach King Rehoboam to see how he's going to rule them. Would he rule them harshly, as they felt his father Solomon had done, or would he be a bit more lenient? So in verse 5, Rehoboam, perhaps wisely at this point, for the last time, buys some time. Give me 3 days, come back, and we'll have a chat about it. During those 3 days, he goes to seek some advice. Verse 6, first he goes to the elders who had served his father Solomon. And they advise him in verse 7, if today you'll be a servant to these people and serve them and give them a favourable answer, they will always be your servants. Unfortunately, he doesn't kind of dig that very much. He doesn't like their advice. So he decides to consult the young men who've grown up with him. And he was serving him. They advise him differently in verse 10. These people have said to you, your father put a heavy yoke on us, but make our yoke lighter. Now tell them, my little finger is thicker than my father's waist. Bragging. My father laid on you a heavy yoke. I will make it even heavier. My father scourged you with whips. I will scourge you with scorpions. Well, there we go. And so Rehoboam decides to follow this advice rather than the advice of the older men. And it has disastrous consequences. He was lacking in wisdom, and this led to a destroying of the unity. See, if the people are united, in verse 16, they're united against the king, aren't they? They kind of come up to king, and they saw that the king refused to listen to them, and they all answered him What share do we have in David? What part in Jesse's son? To your tents, Israel. You look after your own house, David. So the Israelites went home. But as for the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah, Rehoboam still ruled over them. So there's a division in the unity of the people because of his stupidity. Rehoboam makes a couple of efforts to prevent the inevitable happening. Firstly, in verse 18, he sends Adoniram in charge of forced labor, but they stoned him to death. And verse 19 tell us that Israel's been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. Second thing he tries is he begins to initiate all-out war. Or maybe I'll get the kingdom out that way. But God, in his mercy, intervenes to stop him from heading into a certain disaster. And in the meantime, in verse 20, the northern tribes have made Jeroboam their king, and we're told only the tribe of Judah remained loyal to the house of David. So that's the story. And I think what we're seeing is that the word of the Lord that he'd spoken to Ahijah in chapter 11 comes about just as he had said through the stupidity of Rehoboam. The kingdom is divided. And from now on, in the book of Kings, we'll trace two sets of kingdoms. The northern kingdom and their kings, and the southern kingdom, Judah, the sons of David, and his kings. As the Lord had said, Judah has been humbled. God is sovereign over stupidity. Let me try and draw a couple of lessons from that fact. What is it that we learn about the Lord? What is it that we can cling on to? And I think the first thing is that we learn something that is at the same time very scary and comforting about the Lord. Okay, we learn something very scary and at the same time comforting about the Lord. He is faithful in judgment and faithful in mercy. God is faithful in judgment and he's faithful in mercy. And he allows, even plans opposition to his purposes to bring about his purposes. Now this is good news for everyone who's concerned that evil in this world is somehow out of control, isn't it? If you look out on the world and you can see bad things happening, this is good news. God will bring all that to an end. God is a just judge. He is faithful in judgment. There will not be opposition to him forever. If you're concerned that opposition to the church is on the increase, this is good news for you because this will not last forever. God is faithful in judgment. But of course, this only remains good news if you can honestly say that you've never been ruled by evil yourself, isn't it? Because for God to get rid of evil and to be faithful in judgment means that all people who have been ever ruled by evil at all will also face that judgment. Now, most of us, I'd argue all of us, are more in league with evil than we would care to admit. In fact, the Bible teaches us, doesn't it, that we are born opponents of God. We are born his enemies. And so this news that God is faithful in judgment actually can be bad news, except for the fact that God is also faithful in mercy. Well, just as God faithfully and mercifully intervenes in chapter 12, verse 22, when he brings his word through his prophet Shemaiah, God is faithful in his mercy as well as in his judgment. Don't we need God's mercy? How has God intervened to trump our stupidity and to deal with us in mercy? Well, he's given us his word, the Bible, just like he gave it through Shemaiah. He's given us the gospel, the good news that Jesus, in his death on the cross, has taken the judgment of God on our behalf and in his mercy offers a place in his kingdom to all who will believe in him. Let me read you some verses from Acts, which is a book in the New Testament after Jesus has died and has risen from the dead and has ascended into heaven. Peter, one of his followers, puts it like this. This man, speaking of Jesus, was handed over to you. Now, I mean, we'll think about that for a minute. We'll, if you know the story of Jesus, who is it who handed Jesus over? Perhaps you're thinking of Judas. That's true. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to a cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. You know, Jesus is where God is both faithful in judgment and mercy. The cross is where God's sovereignty ultimately trumps our stupidity and brings about judgment and mercy. That's God's doing. Isn't it a wonderful thing that God is doing anything, something, this, in our world today? Now, at this point, the juniors are going to go out and discuss the things that we've been thinking about, and we're going to move on to think about Jeroboam's doing now in verses 25 to 33. We've seen what God is doing. God is sovereign over our stupidity. Jeroboam, well, he is ignorant in idolatry. Now, at this point, we need to remember God's promise to Jeroboam. I don't know if you remember this. It's quite remarkable, really. Jeroboam is promised, even though he's going to have a rival kingdom in some ways, and his kingdom will dominate the kingdom of David's line, God promises him, if he would just obey and let God rule, he promises him a kingdom just like David's. If you've got a, if you can look at it, look at chapter 11, verse 37. This is what God promises Jeroboam. I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You'll be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you, and walk in obedience to me, and do what is right in my eyes, by observing my decrees and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David, and will give Israel to you. Well, isn't that a remarkable promise, do you think? It is. That he would offer this kind of, this blessing to Jeroboam if he would only let God rule. Even though he was a rival kingdom to God's, the kingdom that God had set up. Quite remarkable. And quite remarkable because it makes everything that follows even more devastating. Jeroboam, instead of letting God rule over him and his people by having God in his heart and the hearts of the people, sets up a rival and counterfeit system of worship. It's called idolatry. And we learn some things about idolatry from these verses, which I want to draw out from what we read. The first thing about idolatry that I think we can see is that idolatry is unstable. We see there's a rival capital, or capitals perhaps, in verse 25. Jeroboam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. And from there he went out and built up Peniel. Now, Shechem is where Rehoboam had gone in verse 1, if you remember, hoping to be made king. That's where Jeroboam then settled as king. And then he built up Peniel. It's on the eastern border of Israel. Just, you know, you might know, if you know the geography of Israel a bit, you've got like the far east and then of Israel, and then you've got like a desert, right? So having a city there fortified would be really helpful to protect it from people coming across that way to attack them. But it's possible it became a capital. But even if it didn't, the capital of Shechem wasn't really very secure. Shechem, in verse 16, gives way to Tirzah as a capital, then eventually to Samaria, also in chapter 16. Instability, it seems, becomes a feature of Israel, and I think idolatry is unstable. The second thing we learn about idolatry is that it's inevitable, I think. So we talk about a rival temple. Verse 26 and 27. It doesn't actually say he built a rival temple, but it's clear that the people, the temple in Jerusalem was something he was trying to replace. Look at verse 26. Jeroboam thought to himself, The kingdom is now likely to revert to the house of David if these people go up and offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem. They'll again give their allegiance to their lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. Now, it's interesting, isn't it, that Jeroboam's problems start because he thought to himself. That's always a bad sign, isn't it? It's always a dangerous start when we pay too much attention to our own thoughts. He'd forgotten or just didn't believe what God had said. He'd forgotten God's words, ignored God's thoughts, and listened to his own. And that's where it all goes wrong, and that's where idolatry starts. Listening to ourselves too much, doesn't it? Listening to our own thoughts, forgetting what God has said, ignoring God's promise. And he's riddled with feelings of insecurity, isn't it? He's there going, oh no, everything's going to go wrong. People are going to, like, you know, turn away from me and kill me. I'd better set up this rival temple. Isn't that typical of idolatry? Idolatry begins because we listen to our own thoughts and because we have this natural sense of insecurity that actually we need to find some basis for security, some basis for significance in something other than God and his promises. And all I'm trying to say is that idolatry is inevitable. The Bible teaches us that we're people who are made to be human, is to be worshippers. If you're human here this morning, then you're a worshipper of something or someone. That is just, that's just inevitable. Worship is, if you're not worshipping God, there's something else that you're worshipping. Even if you are worshipping God, there are rivals, aren't there, competing for our attention and for our love and for our affection. The Bible teaches us that to be born in God's image is to be born as worshippers. And if you're not worshipping God, the only true object of worship, the only true object of worship that brings true significance and true security, then you're going to be seeking it in something else. It's called idolatry. And the third thing about idolatry is that it's offensive. See, it's not just a neutral thing. It's actually a massive problem. It's a huge problem. Idolatry is offensive. He sets up rival gods in verse 28 to 30. He sets up two golden calves, one in Bethel, which is kind of at the bottom of his of the border of the kingdom of Israel, and one in Dan, which is perhaps the equivalent of John O'Groats. You know, it's right at the top. You can't go much further before you fall into the, well, not the sea in Israel's case, but, you know, into the next kind of country. So what's ironic about this, or sad actually about this, is that this is just taking us back, isn't it, to Exodus 32. Exodus 32, God has just dramatically rescued his people from slavery in Egypt. He brings them to Mount Sinai, where he's now going to give them his law. And Moses is at the law, is at the top of the mountain, receiving the law. He's a long time. In the meantime, they think he must have died. And so they say to his brother Aaron, "Aaron, here's some gold. Just make us an idol or something, will you? Just give us an idol." And he does. What does he make them? A golden calf. He makes them a golden calf. "These are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." That's what Israel says. This is deja vu, isn't it? We've seen this before. Jeroboam makes identical gods, but two of them. And then he quotes the people from Exodus 32. "Here are your gods, Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." And the point I'm making is really there in verse 30. "And this thing became a sin." This is not a neutral, idolatry is not a neutral place to stand. Denying God our worship is not a neutral place to stand. It is a sin, and it's a real problem because it's offensive to God, and it attracts his wrath and his judgment. It's a real problem. Finally, the idolatry is man-made. See there, he sets up a rival priesthood and a rival festival in verses 31 to 33. a rival priesthood and a rival festival. And the emphasis is all, this is his idea. This is all Jeroboam's doing. Think about that as we read it through. Jeroboam built shrines in high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. You know, this is his idea. God's idea was they were Levites, right? So he's doing it all by himself, out of his own head. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month. That's exactly 1 month after the festival held in Judah. And he offered sacrifices on the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. And at Bethel, he also installed priests at the high places he had made on the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing. He offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. Now, this is the truth we see throughout the Bible, isn't it? God has made us in his image to worship him. If we don't worship him, we'll be worshipping something else. But that thing is always unstable. It's always born out of insecurity. It's always offensive to God. And it's always man-made and attracts God's wrath. About 900 years or so after this event, the man Jesus would stand in more or less the same place as this king Jeroboam. By this time, the rift between north and south is at its peak. They're sworn enemies. But Jesus, the Jew, stops by a well and meets a Samaritan woman. They have a conversation. And in the conversation, the woman says to Jesus, "Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim the place we must worship is in Jerusalem." "Woman," Jesus replied, "believe me, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. A time is coming and has now come when the true worshippers will worship the Father in the Spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshippers the Father seeks." The woman said, "Well, I know that Messiah is coming. When he comes, he'll explain everything to us." Jesus declared, "I, the one speaking to you, am he." You see what he's saying? Jesus is saying, "I'm the Messiah. I am the promised, the chosen king, the anticipated son of David, the one who's going to come to unite his people once again under one leader. I'm the one who's going to bring in God's kingdom. In me, in my coming, God's kingdom has finally come." Jesus marks the end of the humbling of David's line. Jesus is the one who would come, become the new temple. It's through Jesus now that we can offer God true worship. Not in Jerusalem, not in Bethel, not at Dan, not at the altar of two golden calves, not even at the temple in Jerusalem. Not a temple, an altar. Not an altar, a cross. The cross is at the same time an altar where Jesus' death paid the penalty for our idolatry, and the throne through which Jesus irreversibly establishes God's kingdom on earth. Back to our initial question. God temporarily tolerates other religions, idolatry, because he is merciful, not because he is slack. Because he's merciful, not because he is slack. Jesus irreversibly established God's kingdom on earth through the cross. And we look forward to the day when he returns and where all rival thrones will cease and all rival worship will cease. God's kingdom will be synonymous with the world, we might say. Jesus told a parable about the kingdom of heaven. It goes a bit like this. He says, "It's like a man who sowed good seed in a field. But while everyone was asleep, his enemy came and sowed seeds among the wheat, among the wheat, and then he went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed ears, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, 'Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where did these weeds come from?' 'An enemy did this,' he replied. The servants asked him, 'Well, do you want us to go and pull them up?' 'No,' he answered, 'because while you're putting up the weeds, you may uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. First collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, and then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn." Later on, when Jesus explains this parable to his disciples, he says this. Well, he identifies the sower as himself. The field is the world. The good seed are people of the kingdom. The weeds are the people of the evil one. The enemy is the devil. The harvest is the end of the world, and the harvesters are his angels. And he explains the parable like this. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the blazing fire furnace, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Whoever has ears, let them hear. You see what he's saying, can't you? God is not slack. He's merciful. Idolatry exists. There are rivals to God's kingdom, even today, not because God is unable to deal with it, but he has dealt with it, and is at this point extending mercy and grace in order that people may respond. Peter writes this in his second letter. Scoffers will say, "Where is this coming he promised?" Ever heard any of that? Jesus really coming back? "Ever since our ancestors died, everything goes on as it has been since the beginning of creation." Don't we hear that today as well? But they deliberately forget that long ago, by God's word, the heavens came into being and the earth was formed out of water and by water. And by these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. He's talking about the flood, Noah. By that same word, the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly. But do not forget this one thing, dear friends. With the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping his promise. Instead, he is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. We have a patient God, one who has dealt decisively with idolatry, actually. And one day, his kingdom that has been already irreversibly established in the cross will become the kingdom of the world, where we will live in righteousness and peace and joy. That day is coming. Today is the day of opportunity. Today is the day to respond, the day of mercy, the day of grace. If you've got ears, then hear.